a forest fire. Wilbur Black Deer was there in his yard with a dozen friends and relatives waiting to evacuate if they needed to. But what caught my eye in the clearing around his modest house were the frames of long lodges and artifacts of a tradition that I had experienced thus far only in museums or in commercial ceremonies performed for white audiences. The fire never materialized. Wilbur was safe. But my interest was kindled. And about a week later, I went back to visit Wilbur, to ask him about the lodges, to learn about Native Americans and his tribe, the Ho-Chunk, then still known as the Winnebago. Wilbur, who was 75 years old that summer, did not describe himself as having any particular official status in his tribe, but he was, as much as anyone, a spiritual leader. The lodges in his yard were real working lodges used for ceremonies, rituals, and rites of passage. Members of his tribe regularly came to him for guidance. Young men seeking vision quests, couples wishing to be married, children to be named. Wilbur's life's work was to keep alive a way of life, to tell the old stories, to honor his tradition. I spent that summer visiting Wilbur every week or so. We would sit on stumps out in his yard. I learned to bring him tobacco to honor his time with me. Sometimes he would talk for only a few minutes. He'd announce, "Gotta go in the house now," and I knew that was my cue to leave. Other times he'd talk for a long while. I was never really quite sure whether I was assuming too much by showing up, making a pest of myself, but at the end of the summer, Wilbur offered a strong affirmation. I was invited to join him and his family for the harvest feast. On that day, the long lodge was covered over with canvas, fires were lit with a bow and a stick, not with a match. A deer was killed and butchered to be cooked with beef and chicken and pork, with corn and squash from the garden in pails hung over the open fires. When the prep work was all done, the men filed in one door of the lodge and the women through another, and the drumming began. I was assigned to a guide, as I was told that once we were inside, there would be no English spoken. Throughout the afternoon, many dances were held, dances that told the story of the tribe and gave thanks for the harvest. Guests rose to dance before the hosts, honoring them and receiving an offering of tobacco in return through the peace pipe that was drawn from a medicine bundle. When it came time to eat, the pails were portioned out to family leaders who shared with all those around. The meal was eaten without salt or seasoning from wooden hand-carved bowls with wooden utensils. And then came dessert. With more offerings of tobacco, the ceremonial bundle that had been opened on a low mound of white sand was taken up and two wooden bowls were placed on it. Into the bowls was poured a dark, sticky liquid. I looked over at my guide, who muttered, "Buffalo blood." The only English words spoken that all afternoon. As I watched, two of the younger men donned buffalo headdresses and stuffed hare tails into the back of their pants. And as the drums pounded, they began circling the lodge, leading a line of participants as they went. When they reached the bowls, they stooped down on hands and knees, and without touching anything with their hands, like the buffaloes, they slurped up some of the liquid. As each dancer passed, he or she did likewise, and as they danced, they would sometimes lower their heads, make horns of extended fingers, and snort and grunt at each other. There was a lot of laughter in all of this, and after only a pass or two, my guide looked at me and he pointed and indicated that I should join in. more than a little self-conscious about dancing and highly concerned about the blood, I stepped up anyway, and when I came to the bowl, I bent down just as they had, lots of laughter right now, and I stuck my face not into blood, but maple syrup. Howls ensued. When the last bowl was empty, the leader stooped again, and edging his horn under the bowl, he tried to tip it over. The shallow bowl skittered off of its sand dais and landed in the dirt, but remained upright. Everyone laughed. The next dancer tried, and the next with no luck. Finally, an old man with skill born of apparent experience adroitly hooked his forehead under the lip of the bowl and tipped it up on end. It teetered a minute and then fell upside down. And as soon as it landed, the drum stopped and the dance was over. I count that day as one of the great honors of my life. I think that when such a cultural divide can be bridged, when a connection is made, there is real honor. Wilbur's honor of his tradition, too, makes me think of how we honor our tradition, what tradition means for us. And in many ways, we are so totally not like this. We do not do it this way. For one thing, I seriously doubt that I could get all the men to come in that door and all of the women to come in this door every Sunday. But in more fundamental ways, we are a religion that pushes away tradition, a religion that challenges the old stories, the old assumptions. We are constantly seeking, constantly asking questions. Our free and responsible search never quits. We hold to no creed, no revealed truth. We seek truth and meaning from a host of sources, and that host keeps growing as we find more. No story is automatically more sacred than another. Every bit of reality is fair game. On the continuum between immanence and transcendence, most of us lean toward immanence. We say we have an open canon, which means that the poetry of Mary Oliver or the songs of Pete Seeger ring just as true for us as the books of the Bible or the Quran or the Upanishads. We do organize around food, like Wilbur, but our feasts are more likely to offer vegan, free-range, organic, and gluten-free options, or else be catered by the local Italian deli. And when someone suggests that we make a communion of apples or flowers or little jars of water we've collected on vacation, we say, sure, go for it. We speak in the vernacular. We change up the script. Sometimes we even rap. We have stripped our sanctuaries bare of any hidebound symbolism. In our architecture, we have given up the tall spires and the bell towers originally intended to draw our attention upward to a transcendent whatever, because a lot of us have rejected whatever. If there is an idol here, it is only this grimness, this slavish denial of decoration. But even that's up for grabs. You want to dress steampunk? Cool. You want to wear flip-flops instead of wingtips? Fine. Nor do we even hold on to the abstractions of our ancestors. We make no creed of a nugget from Channing or Hosea Ballou. We do not repeat the tropes of the past. We are the religion of change, the religion of no tradition. We are the anti-tradition. We are the uncommon denomination, the religion where all your answers are questioned. We are like perpetual six-year-olds. Why? But we are old, too. We are older than old. If you think of Unitarianism, not so much as a tradition, but as an idea. You can find echoes of the oneness of God in ancient Egypt, long before Christianity. You can find the idea of universal salvation in the theologian Origen from the second and third centuries. And we have great stories, all the stories you need for a great religion. We have stories of martyrdom, like Michael Servetus, burned at the stake in 1553 for the heresy of challenging the doctrine of the Trinity. He reads his Bible, finds no mention of the mystical union of Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, gets all up in John Calvin's business about it, and is burned over a fire of green wood that sputtered and smoked and licked at his flesh for a full half hour before he succumbed. And we have stories of tragedy, like the story of Margaret Fuller, the most learned woman in America at the time, literary critic for Horace Greeley's Tribune, more erudite than any man she ever met. Might have gone on to do even more amazing things, advancing the politics of sexuality in those pioneering days, except that in 1850, at age 40, she and her husband were on their way back from Europe with their two-year-old child when their ship capsized and they drowned. We have schismatic stories, like the story of the American Transcendentalists, the nation's first counterculture, hippies, really, off in the woods, communing with nature, starting actual communes, setting up homeschools, and hiding away escaped slaves. Ralph Waldo Emerson and Theodore Parker, Margaret Fuller, Bronson Alcott, Orestes Brownson, Henry David Thoreau. Emerson, especially, pushing back on his own Unitarian colleagues, whom he thought of as cold and rational, void of any spirit, the pendulum swing of our own liberal faith taking a hard spiritual turn. And stories of sacrifice and prophecy, like the story of the group that came to be known as the Iowa Sisterhood in the late 1800s, when places like Rockford were still on the frontier, but where the New England clergy, all men, of course, were reluctant to go. They were pretty comfortable back in their cozy pulpits with well-to-do congregations. But somebody's got to serve out here, and who should do it? Women. Women previously barred from ordination, women beginning to assert themselves and at the same time willing to do the hard work, to care for congregations, to live through harsh winters in drafty attics with little or no pay. Mary Safford, Eleanor Gordon, Ida Halton, almost 20 more. As our movement grudgingly came to accept them, they forged a new turn in faith. Theirs was a ministry of nurture and community, not blathering abstractions from the pulpit. We even have our own miracle story, the story of John Murray that Kimberly told earlier. Of course, it's a kind of a non-miracle in which nature does nothing unnatural. But how great is that? What do they say about the weather? Just wait, it will change, and when it doesn't, glory be! These are all good stories, all good parts of our tradition. In the back of the hymnal, you can find many more words of prophetic men and women. You can even find Francis David from the 16th century speaking in Hungarian, Egy az Isten, God is one. But still, what does it mean to honor them? Unlike Wilbur Blackdear, and even unlike other traditions much closer to ours, we don't often venerate these ancestors. We do recite their words from time to time, but we do it not so much for the truth that they spoke, but for the fact that they spoke it. We honor our ancestors, we honor our tradition by honoring their spirit, by honoring their lead. They spoke the truth they saw. We should speak the truth we see. They questioned the assumptions of their day, both the assumptions of the culture in which they lived and the assumptions of their own faith communities and colleagues. We should question the assumptions of our day, both of culture and of our own community. This is what it means to witness. This is what it means to testify, to speak the truth you see. What this means, I think, too, is that maybe we are not always going to be popular. We might not be the ones to establish institutions or become the dominant trend. Maybe our role is, and always has been, to live on the edges, to push back on society, to point out things that don't make sense, to call out injustice, to speak the truth. Maybe we are the ones on the margins. Reverend Rob Eller Isaacs has an even better phrase. He says, we are the leaven, not the bread. We're the yeast. You can't make a loaf out of just yeast, of course, but we are necessary. We make things rise. We are the yeasty ones. This is how we do it, right? Raise your hand if you have ever signed a petition. Yes, keep them up. Or had a yard sign, or a bumper sticker, or served on a committee, or worked a phone bank, or voted in an election. Do I have everybody yet? Raise both hands. This is how we do it. This is how we honor our tradition, by being the yeast. We are like Servetus, not because we read our Bibles exactly as he did, but because we call into question, we challenge, and we go to the mat. We are like the Transcendentalists, not because we worship nature, but because no two of us thinks alike. We are like the Iowa Sisterhood, not because we face the same challenges, but because we are willing to do the hard work. Our ancestors were bold. We honor them by being bold, too. A few days after the harvest feast, Wilbur Blackdear was hospitalized for a mild heart attack brought on by a touch of pneumonia caught in the rain. People don't live too long, you know, he told me from his hospital bed. In fact, neither do traditions. Wilbur's tradition, too, has changed over time. All traditions move and grow. Wilbur especially straddled two worlds. Those dancers with headdresses and tails, they wore Reebok basketball shoes on their feet. But even as they step into the future, they hold on to things that matter, that help give their lives meaning. That's how it is for us, too. Just as Wilbur's family gathers around the lodge, we come here to find inspiration, to find spirit. We come here in honor. We come here in tradition. Here we hold ceremonies, rituals, rites of passage. We seek meaning, purpose. We give thanks. We break bread. We hold up the worth and dignity of each person. And we find ways to support and honor family life, too. Couples are married, children are named. We keep alive a way of being, our liberal religion. We keep alive the flame. We honor our tradition. Roots hold me close. Wings set me free. Traditions can live if we keep the fires burning, if we remember, if we honor the spirit of those who have gone before. They live in story and in ritual, in reverence and in connection. They live in honor. May it be so.